Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Welcome to the 10 Adventures podcast. Today's a bit of a different approach. I'm going to answer one of the questions I get asked a lot about what's my favorite trekking route in the world. And so Karen's going to interview me because she actually doesn't know very much about the route I'm going to talk about. Also, this is going to be Karen's last podcast before she goes on a pretty epic bike tour, her first bike tour since COVID. So how are you feeling about your bike tour, Karen?
I'm looking forward to it. It seems like there's still a bit to do to get stuff packed up, but we're going to spend 8 weeks cycling the Eurovelo 1, we're thinking. So starting in Nantes, France, which is along the Loire Valley, close to the Atlantic coast, and going down the Atlantic coast of France into Spain, and then likely continuing through the interior of Spain and around up to Lisbon, where we're flying home from. So we've got 8 weeks to do this bike trip. And to be honest, I don't have a lot of the details planned. I just know when my flight arrives and when my flight goes. And if it turns out it's too far for 8 weeks, well, then I guess I'll get on a train. And if it's too short, I guess I'll see a lot more different areas than what I had planned. So one way or another, it'll work out.
And I know that's your favorite way of traveling, is having that ability to, you know, kind of each day make a decision what you're going to do, where you're going to go. And I think that's going to be an exciting trip. And things look really good right now for that part of Europe in terms of the ability to go there and not have to deal with, you know, a COVID outbreak. So I know you've been worried about that, wondering, you know, what if it was going to happen. And this is finally the first trip I think you've planned that's now going to happen. All systems seem to be ready to go.
Yeah, so far so good. But I must say, one thing I've learned during the pandemic, probably more than what I feel like I was already reasonably flexible with travel. But I think with the pandemic, I'm forced to be a lot more flexible, because who knows what's going to happen, right? I might get there and 2 weeks later, there's a lockdown and I have to get home. So I'm prepared for that. But I guess what we're going to talk about is your favorite trek, which is a trek, as you mentioned, I don't know a lot about, but you've referenced many times in the past, and that was the GR5 that you did several years ago. And I am interested to know more, because though I've heard you mention it, I don't actually know a lot of details about it. I was thinking we should probably start with, you know, why exactly that was a trek you decided to do? Like, what made you want to do that trek, and, you know, how that plan evolved?
Yeah, so I'm a guy who loves to just, you know, buy guidebooks, investigate different routes, you know, read about different treks online. And I also am somebody that loves the Alps. I think, you know, the comfort and the beauty, staying in mountain huts or refuges, as they say in French, is a really beautiful way to travel. And so I was in a really stressful and difficult job and working on kind of projects that lasted 18 to 24 months. And one of my projects was going to be ending in the summer of late spring of 2009. And so I was newly married with my wife. And so we said, what should we do? And I hadn't been trekking in the Alps for 7 or 8 years before that. I'd just been working really hard. And I said, well, you know, why don't we go in and do this route? And we'd kind of been looking at, you know, what we want to do. And she had never done any trekking in the Alps. And this route just seemed to be taking in so many places I'd loved in the French Alps. So it just, you know, kind of worked out. And we, at the start, we had a week in Paris, which was wonderful. In the end, we had some time to explore Italy. So it just kind of came together, everything, you know, work-wise. And then my wife was interested in it, and I was obviously interested in it. So just everything kind of came together.
So you mentioned that the route went through a lot of places that you were anxious to see. So I don't actually know the exact details of the route. So can you tell us a little bit about the route itself?
Yeah, so France has a bunch of, they're called GRs or Grand Randonnée or kind of long distance footpaths. And a lot of these go kind of through just regular French countryside, but some of them go through the mountains. And so the GR5 actually goes from Netherlands all the way down through eastern France and then connects where Lake Geneva is and goes all the way through the Alps down to the Mediterranean. And so we did the section, which is the most popular, which goes from a town called Thonon-les-Bains, which is on the southern portion of Lac Leman, which is right near the Swiss border, and ended up in Nice. So it really goes through places like Chamonix, Val d'Isère, Briançon, which is an incredible, you know, historical, beautiful town, and just stays in the mountains for, you know, 750 kilometers and really takes you through some of the most epic French alpine scenery.
So are you descending out of the mountains during the trip, or are you really staying high for much of it?
So there are, the route goes, you know, so you're going up and down through valleys, but it feels, you know, my memory and my pictures, you know, like any route, the beauty is that you can get really high and the trail tries to hug the mountains. So, you know, yeah, you stay in a lot of towns that are in the valleys, but it's, you don't go into the plains or, you know, the lowlands. You're in the French Alps. Basically, after day two, you're in the French Alps for the next, you know, 700 kilometers every day, all day. Granted, sometimes you go down to villages in the valleys.
Wow, sounds epic. So you said it was over 700 kilometers. So when you were planning to do this trip, how much time were you planning to be spending to do that? And what was your goal as far as mileage? Or were you kind of like me with my upcoming bike trip?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I was working, you know, crazy hours. You know, I think I'd worked 29 days in a row, putting in 60 or 70 billable hours a week, which means, you know, I basically woke up and, you know, ate and showered and worked and went back and ate and, you know, maybe went for a walk, my wife and I. But I was in no physical training. So we left a huge buffer because I didn't know if we're going to need to take a rest day every second day. I didn't train at all for this. And so we budgeted 7 weeks, I think, for the whole trip. And one thing we did is, you know, going to the French Alps in July and August, it can get really, really busy. So our focus was, let's start kind of the first hut we want to stay in. Let's be there the day it opens, which was June 15th. So the goal was, you know, we don't want to plan every day. We just want to see where our bodies take us. We had a plan of what we wanted to do, but I'm sure, as you know, when you're doing a big trip, you know, plans usually go out the window day one. So in the end, it took us, actually, to be honest, I can't remember how long it took us. We took four rest days during the trip. I think it was 28 walking days, four rest days. But that doesn't seem enough. Maybe it was 32 walking days and four rest days. But it's a big commitment. A lot of people, what they do is they break it down into sections. And so, you know, in Europe, people have 4 to 6 weeks of holiday a year, 4 to 8 weeks, actually. And so they'll go and do a 2 week section 1 year and come back the following year and do another 2 week section. It's a long undertaking, and especially for Europe, it's one of the longer mountain only treks you can do.
If you hadn't had time to do any training, how did your body hold up the first week?
So it wasn't that bad, to be honest. I think I'm at a point then and now where I've done enough long walking trips that you kind of have this built-in ability to put in, you know, 15 to 20 kilometers and just kind of deal with it. Now, there's an alternate start that kind of goes straight up from Lac Leman. We chose the typical start, which goes through kind of some rolling foothills from Thonon-les-Bains. And so the kind of the idea was, okay, these first 3 or 4 days, we're not going to be doing, you know, 1,000 meter days. And in fact, during the trip, fitness was never really an issue. The biggest issue I had was I'd gotten new orthotics just before this trip.
Uh-oh.
And the guy I'd gone to for 20 years had retired. So I went to a new kind of big corporation that does orthotics and physiotherapy. And basically I was hobbled kind of from day 5 onwards every night and every morning, just in tremendous pain from these darn orthotics.
Oh gosh. Well, note to self in the future, hey?
I now have a new orthotics guy, and he's always like, yeah, no, wear them for an hour a day for a week, then go to 2 hours. And I told him the story. He's like, yeah, no, those guys were terrible. They give you terrible advice. Because I've been told, yeah, they might hurt a little bit, but just, you know, your feet will get used to it. And so it wasn't until, you know, the last couple of weeks where I said, screw this, I can't walk anymore. I'm taking these orthotics out.
And how about your wife? Had she had time to train before the trip or?
No. But she's somebody who, although never an athlete, has, you know, a strong will and pretty good fitness. So, you know, I feel like the two of us were roughly similar in terms of our, you know, our ability. Like it wasn't like either of us was going way harder or like wanted to extend days. We were pretty happy with, oh, should we stop now? We're both kind of, yeah, now is a good time to stop.
And when you're planning, you know, your days, do you have to know where you're going to end up? Like, because my experiences in the Alps is that there are set places to stop. So, you know, it's not like there's multiple options in a day. Did you find that? Like, okay, you know, are there days where, yep, you just have to do 22K or you just have to do 25K because there's no other place to stop before that?
Yeah, so I've been lucky. The two summers I've spent in the Alps, one was 2002 when in most mountain huts, I was the only person there. And it was actually spooky. You know, you go to a mountain hut that has, you know, on the Tour de Mont Blanc that can fit 200 people, and I was the only guest. In 2009, this was after the global financial crisis. And once again, most mountain huts, you know, when we were there, especially early on, we were the only people there. And so we had a lot more flexibility than most, you know, if you were to do it this, you know, next summer, you would have to, you know, call a couple of days in advance and have a plan for the next few days. We carried a tent expecting that, hey, these mountain huts are going to be full, but we only used the tent a handful of times. And really it was, you know, it was because we were in a beautiful location or there was space in the mountain hut, but the mountain hut was grotty. So my experience is probably a lot different than most people because, you know, you can't just kind of say, hey, you know, should we stop here? Should we keep going? We knew we'd always find accommodation, whereas now, you know, you don't know that. And so, you know, if you find accommodation, you just got to say, okay, we got it now. Let's stay here.
So if I were going to go plan to do this trek next summer, let's say, would I have to pre-book all of my accommodation? And by accommodation, I think you've been referring mostly to mountain huts, right?
Yeah. Well, so just on accommodation, there's mountain huts within the mountains. In the towns, there's, you know, all range of hostels, hotels, gîtes d'étape. And then there's a lot of camping and there's even some free camping. It's not allowed, but you know, free camping, you know, if you're in the middle of nowhere and they don't see you, lots of people choose to do that. What I found is around Chamonix, I would suggest you have those booked. And so if I were to be planning this trip for myself next year, I'd get those mountain huts. I'd get those reserved. There's also a few mountain huts that are pretty small. So I remember, I think we were in Brunissal where the mountain hut had a triple bunk, three level bunk beds, and it was full with a French cycling team. And it was one room and you went in there, there was 20 French guys in cycling bib shorts and just, you know, hot, steamy, and reeked to high heaven because they cycled 150 kilometers that day. And it was the middle of nowhere. And so, you know, there are some places where, you know, the hostels, you know, or the mountain huts really small. And so you would say, okay, if we want to stop there, we're going to have a reservation. I think it's more fun if you play it by ear because, at least in my case, I had, you know, lots of foot issues that, and when my feet were good, we'd go really far. And some days we did shorter distances than we wanted just because I was hobbled by my feet.
But if I was going to do camping for that, then I wouldn't have to book it or plan it all out.
I'm sure there are some campgrounds. I'm sure there'd be some place where you're like, oh, I can't find space. In fact, if you missed the podcast I did with a guy who just cycled 5,000 kilometers around Europe, and he random camped the entire time. So I think in those cases, if you had your own tent, you could just say, you know, oh man, there's nobody around. The mountain huts are all full. The next town is 8 kilometers away. You know, you could probably find a place to set up your tent out of the way. And as long as you don't leave a mess, you should be fine. Now, I'm not advocating that. I'm not suggesting that's allowed. I think it's actually illegal. But if you're in the mountains and you can't get space at the mountain hut, that would be an option that I assume some people do.
I've often heard that the huts sometimes will let you camp outside too. Was that a reality for you or not really?
Actually, you're right. You know, some of the huts do allow camping outside. I know in bad weather, there's, you know, numerous stories of people sleeping throughout the eating area where people are just setting up on benches or on the floor. So, you know, I'm sure there's a way you can get around it. But I think, you know, the worst idea would be I'm going to book these 28 nights in a row, because invariably weather is going to happen, an injury is going to happen. You're going to need to take a day off. You're going to get blisters, something along those lines that, you know, you don't want to be tied to a certain schedule. I think that would be the worst way to do this.
Yeah. I mean, it would be tough. Having said that, I mean, there's other routes, as you mentioned, like the Tour of Mont Blanc, where you actually do need your accommodation booked a lot of the time just because there isn't space because it's so popular. So
the Tour de Mont Blanc is now, you know, getting, you know, for July and August, it's pretty much getting booked up January and February, that in a regular year, you know, you've got to have it planned. I'm going to book my trip, or I'm going to, you know, if you want to try and do it yourself or go with a tour operator, you got to be thinking in the winter before to get your spaces. Otherwise, it's really hard to put together.
Yeah, I've heard this something similar for the Alta Via 1 too in Italy, that it's really hard to get space to do that one as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so kind of the route, if you break it into sections, you know, you can start to look at each of the sections, say, okay, where's the place where it's going to be hard to get accommodation? I'm sure if you wanted to, you could string together kind of, you know, staying in little mountain towns. It goes to a lot past a lot of ski areas. So there's, you know, options there where you can probably, you know, try and limit the amount of effort you have to put in for mountain huts. Because obviously, if you're in Chamonix, there's abundance of accommodation. If you're in Saint-Moëns or Val d'Isère or Tine, you know, there's lots of accommodation there because it's a thriving winter ski area.
How about food when you're doing that trek? Were you cooking for yourselves? Did you have to carry a lot of food, or were you indulging in hot food?
When we went, I was really worried that, okay, we'll have to kind of, you know, take care of ourselves. The huts are all going to be full. So we carried a stove and a cooker for probably the first couple of weeks. And then we're like, there's nobody here. And, you know, French food is obviously fantastic. And so we mailed that back, I think, in Chamonix after a week probably, and said, okay, we're just going to eat everything here. And yeah, the highlight of trekking in Europe is really the food. So
I heartily agree with you on that one. I heartily agree.
Even in, you know, high up in the mountains with nothing around for kilometers, you're at some little mountain hut. And they'll whip up just the most, you're just thinking like, this is better than any food I can get, you know, back in Canada. These guys are incredible, but it's just, you know, the French, truly Italians as well. The Swiss, they know how to cook. So just incredible food. And it's funny, at the end of this, you know, I'd been hiking for 5 or 6 weeks. I came back, I weighed the exact same. And so it's one of the few treks where, you know, you're eating such great food. I was leaner, you know, I'd put on muscle, but I didn't lose any weight. You know, when I've been to Nepal or in the Pyrenees, I guess I cooked in the Pyrenees, but backpacking here in the Rockies, I lose weight in France and also in Italy. Don't expect to lose weight. You'll gain fitness, but you're just going to be eating great food all the time.
Well, no one can complain about that, hey? No one can complain. The food's too good.
Yeah, exactly.
So how was that trekking for so long as a newly married couple?
It went really well. You know, before my wife and I got married, we did a big trip trekking in Bolivia and then a little bit in Peru, and really just kind of went and did like a really hard travel to make sure, hey, how do we travel together? I always think when you're under stress, that's where you see, you know, how you interact. And you know, we got held up in Bolivia. We got terrible stomach issues in Bolivia. We were up in Wiwash, so high altitude diet, altitude sickness, and was really ill. So we dealt with a lot of challenges there. So for us, it was an incredible experience. One thing that was interesting, though, is I'm much more experienced in the mountains than my wife is. And so I've always kind of been the leader. But because of my foot issues, I couldn't be the leader some days. And I still remember we were coming down, coming over a high pass, and I didn't think I could keep going. And I was, you know, this is 10 years ago. I had a big DSLR, a big camera. I had a big pack. We still had, you know, all our tent and a lot of gear. And I just said, I don't think I can make it down to the mountain hut. Like, I got to sit here and I don't know what we're going to do. And I sat there and finally I said, can you carry some of the gear? So he took some of the heavy stuff out of my bag, put it in her bag. And, you know, for me, I'm kind of a guy, you know, push through the pain, you know, don't show weakness. But I think it was a big important moment for our relationship to just say, okay, I asked for help. She actually delivered. She took the lead. She carried a super heavy pack, you know, for probably an hour and a half that day, carried my camera. And that really kind of set up for, you know, us being much more of a team for the rest of the trip instead of it just being me, you know, as the leader, we were, you know, we were a team. And I think that's benefited us in our relationship being kind of more equitable, and we can, you know, we can rely on each other a lot more.
You know, it's funny you say that, because after I got married, my husband and I, we went on a trip to Africa for 4 months. You know, that was a pretty epic experience. But also, as you mentioned, when you're doing those kind of trips, it's really challenging too at times. I remember we were arriving in Kenya on the day of their elections, and there had been a lot of predictions then that there could be civil unrest if, depending on the outcome of the elections. So I remember being terrified, you're not terrified, but like pretty anxious about, oh, should we even be going on this day? But we had to, because my husband had some work commitments, but in the end, everything went okay. But I remember when we came home, we were like, yeah, we've been married for 5 months now. But like after an intense experience like that, it feels like we've been married for years. Because I think you're right. Like you really do get to know your spouse when you're under, you know, stressful and demanding situations. Luckily, much like you, we did well with that stress. Like, you know, it wasn't, it certainly solidified things for us.
I think it's an incredible way just to get to know the person you're going to marry. Like, again, for me, going to Bolivia and Peru was, okay, I really like this person, but how are we going to handle tough situations? And, you know, we had some hairy situations and made it through, and that really strengthened and built our trust with each other.
So did you see her differently after that mountain trek?
I don't know if I saw her differently. It was just much more that we were a team. Instead of me being, you know, okay, I'm going to be in charge, I'm leading this, I'm, you know, I'm indestructible, it was very much, you know, I was much more comfortable asking for help. And that's something, you know, I think for me as a whole, I changed from, you know, being more willing to ask for help when I needed it. Now that was an extreme case, but just even just thinking how I was at work after, as, you know, more willing to say, hey, can you help me solve this? I need help. I can't get all this done. So, you know, the idea of me working, you know, 7 days a week and being at the office Sunday nights, you know, or Sundays from dawn till dusk, I was much more like, hey, I need help to, you know, to get these projects done. So I think it probably changed our relationship and just changed me as well in terms of just my overall outlook.
Now, I know you have 3 young kids. And so I was thinking as you were talking, do you think, like, you've mentioned this is your favorite trek that you've done. Is this something you could see doing with your kids at some point? Like, is it that kind of a trek?
It is tough. So, you know, the one thing about the Alps is they're big mountains with low valleys. And so kind of every day, now, not every day, but there's lots of days where you're going 20 clicks over a pass down to the next valley where, you know, the days can be pretty hard. This wouldn't be my choice of a trip for us to do right now. But, you know, my goal is, you know, within the next 10 years to have my kids able to come and do this as a family. It is just, you know, again, the ability to stay in some towns, stay up high in the mountains, just kind of be in nature for that long is really special. So it's my wife and I, we're both kind of training our kids so we can eventually do this trip.
So that's the dream, is to eventually head out, maybe not the GR5, but do a big.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, when we look, it's like, okay, let's go do something in the UK, maybe do, in fact, right now we're debating between Hadrian's Wall and the coast to coast. The coast to coast is tougher, but you know, it's a pretty epic trip, and then go down to Patagonia and do something, and then come back and do a shorter alpine trip, and kind of, you know, at some point say, okay, yeah, these guys can make it. I don't know when that is. Our youngest is 6, so it's probably not in the next few years, but you know, it might be in 5 years that we're out as a family doing this. That'd be kind of a real great success, you know, for me at least, I think for my wife as well, in terms of, you know, getting our kids able to do something like this.
That would be really cool, like to head off to the UK and do one of those multi-day walks with your kids. That would be epic.
Well, especially because there's so much history. And actually, one thing that's interesting about the GR5 is it does pass through some of the front lines from the First World War. And so I remember coming up one pass, and all of a sudden there was an old fort there, you know, stone fort. And, you know, you actually are walking through history. You know, the town of Briançon is a beautiful old, you have an upper town that's ancient with cobbled streets. And, you know, it really does kind of bring some of the beauty of Europe and the history, you know, with, you know, the beautiful, obviously, mountains and at least from where they're, incredible weather. You know, it's just warm and dry every single day. So it's really nice Really nice place to go trekking.
Sounds fantastic. So you were talking about how you had the issues with your feet that kind of limited what you were able to do at times. Were there any things that happened that were dangerous or where you felt like you were in danger?
So the route is actually, it's a pretty safe route. There's a couple steep bits, but there's, you know, there's no exposure or danger that way. What actually was the weirdest part, and I think was probably pretty dangerous, is I mentioned earlier, we got to a lot of these mountain huts and we were the only people there, and we arrived at one, and the guy who was working there was really like weird. Like he was angry we'd shown up without calling, but you know, I had my phone and said, look, and I had called, no one picked up. And then he looked at his phone and said, oh yeah, you did call. I must have had my ringer turned off. But he was a weird, and there was something off about him. He kind of kept staring at us, and then he brought out these shots and he said, oh, you have to drink these shots.
Oh wow.
My wife and I had talked, but I had a really bad vibe from him. And he left the shots. I said, oh, we're just gonna finish our meal. And when he walked away, my wife said, this guy freaks me out. Like, I think there's something nefarious about this guy. And I'm like, I feel the exact same way. So we poured our shots on the ground and then thanked him. But, you know, I've never been scared in, you know, in a mountain hut in that way. But I feel like, you know, if I was ever going to be drugged or anything crazy happened, that was the guy. And it's just weird. My wife and I had the exact same feel. And after being so mean to us, then just to angrily, you know, or kind of nicely, I guess, bring out these shots of Genepi, which is a little liquor. That was probably the weirdest and scariest moment.
That's your psycho moment.
It's funny because it's like, there's a lake out front and it's like, who knows what the hell this guy could do? No one knows where we are. You know, this is before, you know, there was broadband everywhere. We just had an old phone where you could send a text message. So I send a text message when I get to town every, you know, every couple of days. But yeah, that was a really scary moment. Now, there was another scary moment, which happened on our first or second night. We came into a campground. It was raining. It was, you know, dark. Been a long day. And we couldn't find, like, it's not like a campground here where there's like, you go through a central area and there's, you know, a ranger working there. This was a town campground. And everything else in the campground, like all these, there were big trailers and they've been there for a while. And I'm like, is this even still a public campground? And no one's around because it's, you know, early June. We notice, we just take a site and we're just in a small tent. We start cooking and we notice like people just coming out and looking at us. Really weird because it's like there's 20 campers and we are like as far away as possible. And then you just look around and there are just faces popping out, windows opening. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? And I'm like, this is super, super weird because it's just like bunches of eyes. And then finally some kids came over, you know, like 6 or 7 year old kids and started talking and their French, you know, I speak French quite well. I could barely understand their French. I was like, what the hell is going on here? Then some adults come over and we tell them what we're doing. We tell them we're Canadian. And then just everything changes from this like threatening, aggressive, you know, there's some shouts and then everyone's over happy, you know, chatting and they're bringing us food. They can't believe we'd walked, you know, from a town 20 kilometers away. The kids are coming over. Everyone's touching all our stuff. It's, you know, I'm like, what the hell's going on? And later we find they're Roma gypsies.
Oh.
And so they were occupying that campground illegally and they thought that we were police or going to evict them, which, you know, but they were so kind to us. You know, they gave us just incredible food, a great campground neighbors. But we were tired. We went to bed at, you know, 9 o'clock at night. They kept the party going. You know, we'd had a bit of wine with them. They kept the party going until about 5 a.m. screaming, partying. And so it was just, we walked out of there and we're like, what the hell have we just experienced? A Roma gypsy in encampment. And they were just, you know, the friendliest people on earth once they knew we weren't the law.
So it sounds like something that started a bit unnerving and turned out it was like actually a highlight of the trip.
It was a total, you know, kind of, you think, oh no, what are we doing? We're in this little small, you know, the small towns there literally might have a cafe. So like, these are small towns of 50 or 60 houses where there's nothing. And this actually had a Safeway about a kilometer outside of town, but the actual town didn't have a restaurant, didn't have a hotel. It was just this one little campground. So we're like, who do we turn to if this is trouble? You know, when they're all looking at us, we're like, what the hell do we do? Should we pack up and keep going? Like, there's another town an hour away. But we were glad we did. It was a really unique experience to have that.
So are there any other experiences that, you know, stick in your mind as highlights or humorous events?
You know, probably the two of the best points were in Chamonix and Val d'Isère. We stayed in a hotel. And so in Chamonix, it was the end of, I think, 5, 6 or 7 days walking. We're sweaty. We're stinky. I'm just like, let's get a hotel. And so we go to the central tourist information and they say, oh, you know, the Grand Hotel Mont Blanc. They have a deal right now because you're early season. It's 110 euros a night. And I looked over. I'm like, there's other places for 50 euros. And the one was like, this is a great deal. You should really stay there. So we went there. We walked in and we were just, you know, I had a beard and scraggly hair. And, you know, we smelled terrible. And they gave us a weird eye. And it's I think, the oldest hotel in Chamonix. It's a beautiful old building. But we told them we're doing the GR5. They're like, oh, we'll upgrade your room. And so our room was 800 or 900 square feet. Is enormous. You know, you could do sprints from one end to the other. We had a big shower, still looking a bit scruffy. We went down to the pool, the only outdoor pool in that part of Chamonix. And I'm like, let's get something special. Let's order a cocktail. And the waiter came by and he was looking at us weird because I can't remember. I think I was just in like short shorts or something because I wear those for like showering. And so I said, oh, can we get two cocktails? He's like, I need to see your room key. their typical clientele. Because it was everyone else there was, you know, in their, you know, mid or late 60s. And it was a very refined, high-end place. We just, you know, we just got this great last-minute deal because we just walked into Chamonix. And then in Val d'Isère, we got a couple bottles of champagne and just, you know, toasted kind of. That was for us. It wasn't the halfway point, but it was like, okay, we're going to be able to do this. And just remember drinking Veuve Clicquot in our hotel room with a bag of potato chips and just like really being happy that, hey, we're going to be able to do this. Even though we're not even halfway there, we know now that all, you know, we can do this.
That would be a great feeling. I bet your wife liked that deal you got at the fancy hotel as well.
She just wanted to wash her hair. And like, again, we didn't really know what this place was at the start. She's like, do you guys have shampoo? Because we didn't even have shampoo. And the woman in the front's like, of course we have shampoo. And it was, you know, it's like 1,000 euros a night or something for the room we had in regular season. So we just got a smoking deal on that.
Wow. What an experience, hey? And what contrast to a mountain hut too, hey? With your robe and your shampoo and your slippers and your outdoor pool and cocktails. Yeah, it would be a fun contrast.
It definitely was the nicest place we stayed in on that on the GR5.
So when you're traveling that route, is it pretty standard the direction you go? Like, is it one way and that's it?
So I've only met people that go from north to south. You could go from the Mediterranean up to Lac Léman, and that might, maybe you could start a bit earlier. But everyone I know has done it from Lac Léman south down to Nice. Now, there are a couple of variants. And so kind of the two biggest, obviously I mentioned there's the variant at the start. There is a variant in Parc National de la Vanoise, which is just a stunning, stunning, really high alpine area, which is near where Val d'Isère, which is the famous ski resort, and Tiens are both in there. And there's one route that you can go down along the valley bottom through some just stunning villages. The other route goes up high, kind of stays up high right through the center of the park. And so that's one variant where, you know, you have that option. And the second variant is where you end. And so we finished in Nice because we were tuckered out by then. We're like, this is great. We just want to go sit on a beach. But there's a second option that takes you through Mercantour National Park, which is really, really beautiful. And so you basically leave it. I think it takes 3 or 4 days more. It's a more challenging route. And that has you end up in Menton. The beauty of that variant is it's just a lot more rugged. And you're in a park the entire time. So there's almost no towns. Whereas when you come down the last little bit to Nice, you're going through little hill towns, which are beautiful and really cool. But you're kind of out of kind of the mountains. Sorry, you're not out of the mountains. You're out of nature because as you're coming down to Nice, there's just, you're losing kind of being in the high mountains where you can't see towns anymore. You can all of a sudden see, oh, there's a village, you know, in the valley bottom, or there's another hilltop town across the valley.
So after 5 weeks walking, or maybe even a little bit more with your rest days, how did you feel when you walked into Nice?
I expected it to be monumental, but like these things, they never are monumental. No one, you know, you kind of walk right through central Nice. You know, you spend, I think, 5 kilometers walking through like busy Nice to get to the shore, and no one there knows what you're doing. You're just some grubby backpacker. So it was really, you know, nice for us. We took some photos, but our biggest thing was like, we just wanted to have a shower. We were grotty, and then we wanted to buy clothes because, you know, we just had our hiking clothes. And so it was great to do that. We just wanted to get clean, get new clothes, and then go and eat because our bodies were hungry because we just done a big trip.
Nice.
The best part actually was we finished it quicker than we thought. You know, we only took 4 rest days. And we made pretty good mileage, even with my feet. You know, we were able to, you know, like all these things, once you get going, you do good days. And so we then spent 2 weeks in the Italian Riviera and just, you know, fell in love with the food there. And just it's beautiful. It's not as busy, not as commercialized as the French Riviera. And so just ate incredible Italian food and then sat on the beach eating coconut and ice cream, whatever was coming by. And just, you know, that was a perfect end. You know, we had Paris and culture to start, then a hard trek, and then just like relaxing in the Mediterranean and exploring, you know, little villages and whatnot was really fantastic.
So you didn't feel compelled to walk for those last few days?
We had one hotel that was like a 40-minute walk into town. We both would begrudge that 40-minute walk. Like, how can we complain about this? Like, it's 40 minutes. We just walked for, you know, 700 kilometers.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about the GR5. And I must say, you've got me thinking. Like, now I'm thinking, maybe I do have to plan a big trek like that for next summer, because that sounds pretty epic. And I would be interested in those 2 alternate routes you talked about, going through the Vanoise and the Parc Mercantour. Yeah, that sounds epic.
Yeah, I think, you know, everyone thinks of the Alps and thinks of kind of these, you know, 7 to 12 day itineraries, you know, the old route to Zermatt, the Altavia 1 and 2, the Tour de Mont Blanc, the Tour of the Matterhorn, you know, trips like that. But there are a couple of long trips where, you know, just staying in the Alps, you know, it's, you can do it here in North America. You know, there's the John Muir Trail, there's section hike in the PCT or the CDT, there's, you know, all the long trips in the Rockies. But those are really hard because you've got to think of your camp, you got to secure your campsites, you got to carry your own food, you got to resupply. In the Alps, like, you don't, you know, you can find like these one-off hotels in the middle of nowhere or these mountain huts, or you can get into a village where, you know, you don't have to carry, you know, maybe you carry a day's food because you have a long walk. But even if I think back to the GR10 in the Pyrenees, you know, you had days where you wouldn't be getting anywhere to buy food or to eat food for a few days. You have to carry a lot. Whereas in the Alps, it's just so developed in that part that, you know, you kind of lose all the worries of sustaining yourself, and you can just enjoy the walking and the beauty of, you know, this beautiful, beautiful mountain range.
Sounds epic.
It's pretty good. You should do it.
I'm thinking about it. Absolutely.
I think we've covered everything about the GR5. I know I talk to people about it and they always ask questions. So hopefully we shared why this is beautiful. I know doing this, I kept thinking, oh, do I want to tell people about this? Because I feel it's like one of these undiscovered gems. And, you know, I think back to other routes I did 20 years ago that were, you know, beautiful and not very popular. And then they became popular. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want the GR5 to become really popular, because it is, you know, you see what's happened with the Pacific Crest Trail here, where it's become, you know, like a highway, and you see other parts. But if you're looking for a great adventure that's beautiful and easy, the GR5 really is a wonderful trip.
It sure sounds like that. Thanks so much for telling us all about it.
I'm happy to tell it, Karen, and I can't wait till you get back and we can hear more about your trips cycling in Spain and France and maybe even a little bit of Portugal if you go that far.
I hope so, yeah. I hope it all goes smoothly.
I'm sure it will. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.